Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The U.S. Postal Inspection Service recently gave an update on its Project Safe Delivery. It's been a year-long effort by the agency to prevent threats and attacks on letter carriers and mail theft incidents. Joining us with some details about the progress that the agency has made, Michael Martell from the USPIS. Michael, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Absolutely. So why don't we just start from the beginning? Tell me about Project Safe Delivery and what it is aiming to do, and then we can kind of get into what it has done.
Sure. So last May, Project Safe Delivery was launched, and that is a joint initiative between the Postal Service and the Postal Inspection Service to address the recent rise in threats and attacks on our letter carriers and mail theft incidents. And of course, to keep the nation's mail and packages safe.
And how does it go about doing that when you say it shows initiative? Is it just mostly going after specifically those crimes, or is there just a more onus on it? Because that sounds like it should just be, you know, business as usual for the inspection service.
Actually, it's not. This is, like I said, a joint venture between the Postal Service and the Inspection Service. So we're not going at it alone here. So it employs a holistic approach to address these crimes. We seek to, you know, protect postal employees and the mail stream, prevent incidents from occurring through education and awareness, and of course, as postal inspectors, enforce the laws that protect the nation's mail stream.
Gotcha. Okay. So this is, in addition, you're getting some help from other agencies and law enforcement partners. Who would those partners be? Is that local and other federal enforcement agencies, or who else are you working with?
First and foremost, the Postal Service. They're out there delivering every day, and they're the ones that are upgrading sort of the physical security of our blue collection boxes and locks. And, you know, the letter carriers that are serving the American people on the street every day. But of course, federal law enforcement partners to state and local law enforcement partners, as well as prosecutors, federal, state and local prosecutors as well. All of those parties are really helping us make a difference here.
Gotcha. Okay. And before, I promise we'll get to the results shortly, but, you know, just on background, again, you had mentioned the rise in crimes against postal workers and mail theft incidents. Was there a catalyst that you all really identified that before, you know, something was finally said, all right, we got to do something about this? You know, what was the thought process there before initiating Project Safe Delivery?
So really, after coming out of the pandemic, after the pandemic, we saw a rise in letter carrier robberies and associated mail theft. So robberies of our carriers for access devices to the mail stream. Those individuals then would sell that access device or use it to steal mail themselves and commit associated financial crimes.
Gotcha. Okay. And you all were just paying attention and just saw that the numbers were just creeping up and up and thought, okay, we really got to do something about this. And, you know, this isn't business as usual.
Well, absolutely. So remember, letter carriers are fellow postal employees to us in the inspection service. And letter carriers are out there on the street serving the American people day in and day out. They're being accosted just trying to do their jobs. And that's something that we take to heart here at the Inspection Service, and we really need to provide them the level of protection they deserve.
We're speaking with Michael Martell, who is with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service. So let's get into what has been the effect so far. You all have put out an update on exactly what you all have found and how you have stepped up enforcement. What have you all been able to accomplish so far?
When it comes to upgrades to protect the mail stream, the Postal Service has installed over 15,000 high-security blue collection boxes. Those boxes look the same on the outside, but feature a number of upgrades on the inside to defend against a variety of attacks. And they've also installed over 30,000 electronic locking mechanisms. And that electronic component provides a lot of capability when it comes to being able to secure the mail stream after an incident and, of course, thwarting these criminals, taking away the very thing that they're after in these robberies, and that's access to the mail stream.
Gotcha. And as far as protecting the mail carriers themselves, what actions have been taken in way of ensuring that these postal employees that you mentioned are fully protected and that the laws going against them are, there's usually the complaint of, you know, these crimes are perpetrated and then nothing really happens about them. How are you all making sure that you see through the end that enforcement is taking place?
That couldn't be further from the truth, Eric. So as part of Project Safe Delivery, we've made over 213 arrests since the start of the project for specific postal-related robberies. And we've made well over 1,000 arrests since the start of the initiative in regards to mail theft. And really, I have some trends here over this past 6 months. So in the past 6 months, letter carrier robberies or postal-related robberies are down by 21% versus the same time period the previous year. And number of arrests associated with postal robberies are up 72%, again, in that same time period. And what we're seeing as well is mail theft complaints are down about 35% in that time period. What that's doing is showing these efforts are paying off and they're making a difference.
Gotcha. And what about the folks that it actually affects? I know that you had mentioned complaints of mail theft have gone down, but what about the postal carriers themselves? Are you hearing positive results from them and they feel a little bit safer and not as vulnerable when they are out there, like you said, just doing their jobs?
I think there's always progress to be made there. I think those numbers sort of speak for themselves. But in addition to those, something that's been highly effective is the large increase in the reward program for postal-related crimes. So as of right now, if you rob one of our Postal Service letter carriers, there is a price of up to $150,000 on your head after that incident. That's more than triple than it was before the program rolled out.
And more than likely, what you're stealing from that mail carrier is not going to be worth $150,000 if that's usually the case, right?
No, I mean, you know, I don't know what your electric bill is worth, but, you know, if they want that, they can have it.
And as far as technologies, you had mentioned the new high security blue collection boxes, electric lock mechanisms. You know, obviously, you know, you may not want to give away too many secrets, but are there other areas that you all are looking into as far as improving the actual technology that the Postal Service uses and ways to secure that?
Of course, Eric, we're always evaluating the current environment and looking for ways that we can enhance the security of the mail stream. And the upgrades that you just mentioned, not only are we putting those items out, but as they're rolling out, we're doing so strategically and to maximize their effect out on the streets. And as of right now, high security collection boxes and those electronic locking mechanisms have been deployed to all 50 states.
And you're getting some help as well from technology that the Postal Service isn't even responsible for. You know, everybody has a Ring camera now on the front of their door mostly, and I'm sure that they have caught several incidents of people breaking into mailboxes or even going after postal employees. Are you all utilizing any other technologies that, as I said, you know, aren't necessarily yours, but you'll take any help you can get?
I mean, it brings up a greater point. The public can, of course, help us in our mission to keep your letter carrier safe. They're serving you in your community on a daily basis. So if you have Ring doorbell footage of an incident, reach out to the Postal Inspection Service at 1-877-876-2455. But in addition to that, you can keep an eye out for your letter carrier. If you see someone suspicious around a mail receptacle or following your letter carrier, call 911 and then report it to the Inspection Service.
And let's talk timeline. You know, this is obviously something that you all are happy about the results that you're seeing. Is this going to be a continued effort for the foreseeable future, or is this going to just kind of be the norm as we go further?
Well, absolutely. We are not done. There are thousands more of these blue boxes and electronic locking mechanisms to be deployed, and many more efforts across the nation to, of course, enforce the law that protect the nation's mail system in the form of these law enforcement surges. And what that has done is the Postal Inspection Service is sending national law enforcement personnel, postal inspectors, and other personnel to the hardest hit areas for concentrated efforts. And we're seeing great results there as well.
Michael Martell is with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, and we'll be sure to have you back for an update. But thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
And you can find a link to more information along with this interview posted on our website. Head to federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Colmstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.